This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, March 15, 2006. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. On today's newscast, we'll hear from New Orleans, where the Catholic Archdiocese closes the oldest African-American church in the nation. Native Americans protest the construction of a new biker bar on sacred land in South Dakota.
What it boils down to is desecration of a sacred site. It's a national monument. All Americans should be outraged about this.
And a 241-mile peace march highlights the Latino voice of opposition to the war. We'll bring you those stories and more after the headlines.
From WBAI in New York, I'm Mitch Jezrich with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. The UN General Assembly has voted overwhelmingly to create a new human rights organization, despite opposition from the U.S., Haider Rizvi reports from the United Nations.
The United Nations has created a new human rights body that will replace the Geneva-based Human Rights Commission. As many as 170 countries endorsed the resolution, while the United States, Israel, Palau, and the tiny nation of Marshall Island voted against it. The United States opposed the resolution because any country with a simple majority vote in the General Assembly can become a member of the new council. The U.S. had proposed that the new members must obtain 2/3 of the votes. Observers say this could have made it difficult for some member nations from the developing world to obtain membership. The United States proposal was aimed at excluding countries like Cuba, Sudan, Belarus, and others, which it considers as abusers of human rights. In a hard-hitting speech after the vote, a Cuban delegate accused the United States and the European Union of following double standards in the observance of human rights. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned Israel's arrest of the former leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine as it seized a Palestinian jail in Jericho. Abbas said that the raid was an unforgivable crime and a humiliation to the Palestinian people. Manar Jabreen has more.
Hundreds of angry Palestinians rallied in the streets and declared a general strike today in the Palestinian territories in protest of the Israeli siege of Palestinian jail in Jericho, where Ahmed Saadat, Secretary General of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and six of his comrades were arrested after a 10-hour siege. Meanwhile, nine internationals who were abducted in the West Bank and Gaza Strip in the wake of this attack were all released unharmed. Members of the Palestinian resistance fired six homemade shells on Israeli targets. The Israeli army shelled the northern part of the Gaza Strip. No injuries were reported. Israeli army extended the closure imposed on the West Bank and Gaza Strip because of the Jewish holidays this Saturday. The closure was supposed to be lifted on Wednesday, signaling that the military operation is not over yet. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, this is Manar Jibreen.
Deposed dictator Saddam Hussein has begun his first formal defense at his trial for the 1982 massacre in Dujail. Hussein described the court as a comedy.
I was patient and I am confident of my people and will speak in front of the world. And my confidence will remain.
The judge closed the hearing to the public after Saddam Hussein called on the Iraqi people to resist the invaders. Protests against the French government's new youth employment law continue today. Tony Cross has more.
Four students and a homeless man were charged today after yesterday's clashes outside the Sorbonne. At least nine riot police officers were injured as some of the crowd threw rocks, bottles and metal barriers at them. They responded with tear gas. Today, about 200 students rallied near the university to call for the protests to end. But they continued in several towns and cities, with southbound trains briefly blocked from leaving Paris's Montparnasse station. Yesterday, President Jacques Chirac, who was on a visit to Berlin, expressed support for embattled Prime Minister Dominique de Villepin for the first time. The opposition socialists appealed to the Constitutional Council to block the law on procedural grounds and on the grounds that it contravenes the constitutional principle of equality. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
In a series of demonstrations leading up to the third anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, MediaChannel.org and United for Peace and Justice kicked off Tell the Truth About the War campaign today. One of the organizers, Priya Reddy, told WBAI's Wake Up Call that today's demos are targeting media outlets throughout the country.
The anti-war movement is finally really recognizing the central role of the media in promoting this war, and if we hope to stop this war or any other, I'm afraid we're going to have to, really understand the media role and confront it.
This Saturday, there will be a massive demonstration against the war in New York and in Los Angeles. The New York City Council is considering a proposal that would allow documented immigrants to vote in local elections. Rebecca Miles has more.
The Voting Rights Restoration Act, supporters say, would give more than 1.3 million New York City residents a voice in a city where they contribute $18.2 billion in New York State income taxes. A citizen from Ecuador, but a New Yorker most of her life, Diana Salas, a researcher at the Woman of Color Policy Network, said the slogans and soundbites against giving votes to non-citizens are not new.
All of the early struggles pose the same stereotype, that we're miseducated, that we don't know American politics, that we don't have a right to say. But as an organizer, I will tell you that education on voting is something that has to be done across the board, not just for immigrant communities, but for all communities.
Similar legislation was introduced to the City Council last year, but it failed to pass. This year, the draft bill has more co-sponsors and supporters. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting.
And I'm Mitch Jezerich with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News.
Immigration legislation being debated in the Senate is in danger of not meeting the deadline imposed by the Senate leader, and the stalling could cause the Judiciary Committee's efforts to be futile. But, as Leanne Caldwell reports, one decision made by the committee would allow the sharing of immigrant status information between local law enforcement and the Department of Homeland Security.
The Senate Judiciary Committee has been unable to bring to a vote two key amendments that will help define the scope of immigration reform. Both are authored by Democratic Senator Richard Durbin from Illinois. The first would take out a provision in the proposed bill that would give all undocumented immigrants living in the United States a misdemeanor crime with a maximum sentence of 6 months in jail. Ranking Democrat Patrick Leahy from Vermont supports Durbin's amendment.
I look at parents and their little children and all, and let's not make a whole new criminal class in America. It's not going to benefit us, and it's not going to be the America that welcomed my grandparents or welcomed my wife.
The second would allow humanitarian aid for undocumented immigrants. The proposed bill would allow emergency aid only, such as hospital care or emergency shelter. All other forms of assistance would be a crime. Author of the amendment to change it, Senator Durbin.
Let us provide for real humanitarian assistance. Let us not criminalize those who are reaching out in a compassionate way to help victims, to provide the most basic requirements of life, whether it's food or clothing or shelter or counseling, that a person may need if they're in undocumented status. Let us not make that a crime.
Both amendments have some opposition, and some on the committee say it's unwise to decide consequences for undocumented immigrants before it is determined what type of legal status, if any, will be given to them. As debate on these key amendments and on some other small ones showed no signs of waning, the focus shifted on if and how the committee will be able to produce a bill. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist said the committee needs to present the Senate with immigration legislation by March 27th, or he will introduce his own. It is likely that his bill will be similar to the House version, addressing only border enforcement and calling for the mandatory felony prosecution of undocumented immigrants in the United States. Democratic members of the Judiciary Committee have asked Senator Frist to reconsider his timeline, but Frist gave no indication this afternoon that he will.
My intent is to take it to the floor then. It's an important issue. Border security is absolutely has to be addressed, as does the enforcement and other issues surrounding immigration.
The Senate bill was expected to include enforcement provisions, but also include a guest worker program or some sort of legalization process. But Judiciary Committee members haven't even come close to debating that. So, some are supporting the idea of splitting the bill into two. Republican Senator Tom Coburn from Oklahoma.
My suggestion is to break this into two bills. One, it satisfies some of the time requirements. It does place border enhancement security, so that no matter what we do on these other issues, we have control or started to control the problem. And then we move in this same Congress in a reasoned period of time with reasoned debate and consensus building to address the other issues. And I believe anything other than that's not going to get us an immigration bill, and I think what we're doing here is going to fail.
But many are likely to oppose that. The only significant measure voted on today was to allow the sharing of information between the Department of Homeland Security and local law enforcement. The amendment was agreed to along party lines. Angela Kelly is Deputy Director of the Immigration Law Forum.
There are so many families that are mixed status families, where you've got a mom with a green card, a 7-year wait for her husband to get legal status, so he's here illegally, a U.S. citizen-born child, and maybe an undocumented teenager. I mean, that's a very typical immigrant family with mixed status. You throw the prospect of them at them of police being able to check their green cards, whether they have legal status or not, check their papers, that makes that family afraid to report a crime, afraid to report domestic abuse, sometimes afraid to go to the doctor. And that is the most counterproductive direction in terms of effective enforcement that we would want to take as a country.
The Judiciary Committee plans to get back to work tomorrow on this legislation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf addressed a joint session of Congress today. Johnson Sirleaf is the first woman elected to lead an African nation and the first black woman to ever speak before both houses of Congress. She cited the connections between Liberia and the United States as Liberia was founded by freed African American slaves nearly 200 years ago. She spoke about the problems Liberia is facing in rebuilding after years of civil war, where she pledged to build an honest, safe, and economically sound country with the help of the United States.
I have many promises to keep. As I won elections through a free and peaceful process, I must preserve freedom and keep the peace. As I campaigned against corruption, I must lead a government that curbs it. As I was elected with the massive vote of women, I must assure that their needs are met.
Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, President of Liberia, speaking before both the House of Representatives and the Senate.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org.
The Catholic Archdiocese of New Orleans closed the oldest African-American church in the nation today. The church was a historic landmark and a community center with a strong tradition of spiritual music. FSRN's Christian Roseland has more.
These bells have rung in the yard of St. Augustine Church in New Orleans for 165 years. However, after today, they will not ring for the parish of St. Augustine Church, as the Archdiocese of New Orleans has officially closed the parish of the oldest racially mixed church in the nation. Yesterday at 2 p.m., nearly 100 parishioners and their supporters arrived at the church to protest the closure, which was followed by a 10-hour prayer vigil. Many say that this is another injury to a community that is already suffering from displacement. Dildra Square was part of the congregation of St. Augustine and attended the protest.
I can't understand why a city that's so displaced and it's under so much distress, and the only place you can seek refuge and comfort is in your church, in your church home, your church family. And people who say that they're Christ-like and people of the word and of the cloth could come and dissolve it. I can't see the logic behind something like that. I just can't see it. You know, this is a time more than any to console each other and to comfort each other and to be there for everybody.
However, officials with the Archdiocese point out that parishioners will be consolidated into another nearby African-American church, which will have the option of using the church for Mass. Father William Maestri told FSRN in an interview that the Archdiocese office feels that the church is no longer able to provide adequate services to the congregation. President of the Pastoral Council of St. Augustine, Sandra Gordon, disputes that claim and says that the church had offered to pay its own expenses. She says that many families have several generations that attended the church. Gordon's mother was converted to Catholicism at St. Augustine, and her grandchildren attend service there. St. Augustine was built 2 decades before the Civil War by free people of color. The racial integration of its congregation was cited as a model for churches worldwide by Pope John Paul II in 1987. Civil rights heroes such as A.P. Thoreau and Homer Plessy, of the landmark Jim Crow era case Plessy v. Ferguson, prayed there. Al Harris has attended St. Augustine for more than 30 years. He says part of the importance of the church is the diversity of its congregation.
This church is many colors, many races. We say save St. Augustine's parish. And all churches should be like St. Augustine. That was said by Pope John Paul II in September of 1987. And we believe in that.
Harris also explains that much of the musical traditions of black spiritual music originated in churches like St. Augustine, which had two rows of pews for slaves purchased by the free African Americans in the congregation.
Slaves who worshipped here in the 1800s, when they left here, they walked three blocks to Congo Square, and that's where our rhythm and blues comes from, our gospel music, our gospel, you know, our religion, the whole nine yards. It originated sitting in the side pews here at this church, listening to the spirituals and the word of the Lord and moving on out and feeling jubilant. And
for FSRN, I'm Christian Roseland.
Six months after Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, native tribes in the bayous of Louisiana are struggling to survive and rebuild. The erosion of the wetlands and marshlands they call home is repeated each hurricane season, and a lack of federal recognition of their native status means that the already paltry government aid is even slower in coming. But four tribes, the Bayou Lafourche, Ile Jean Charles, Grand Caillou du Lac, and the Pointe aux Chiens, have begun working together to leverage whatever aid comes their way and try to preserve their way of life before it's too late. FSRN's Andrew Stelzer has more from Pointe aux Chiens, Louisiana.
They're saying for us to leave and not come back? When they're not going to help, I mean, what else are you supposed to look at?
Marlene Foray, chief of the Grand Caillou du Lac Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha, says that with the press and what few resources there are focused on New Orleans, FEMA trailers have just begun to trickle in to aid families who've lived on the bayou for years, and some may begin to leave if conditions don't improve soon.
Down in this area, like you're going to take Grand Caillou du Lac, we had one big grocery store down there, and it's gone. They're not reopening. You know, the industry's practically zero, except for the shrimping businesses, but there are a lot of them are folding and not reopening.
The Grand Caillou only has three families whose homes were destroyed by Hurricane Rita's floods. Comparatively, they were lucky. Albert Nakin, the chief of the Isle de Charles Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha Confederation of Muscogees, says 30 out of 52 homes of his tribe's members were flooded. Basically any that were not more than 13 feet above the ground.
We have people that can't afford a sewage system, and if you can't afford an updated sewage system, well then you don't get your FEMA trailer.
Each time the region floods, the waters seem to get higher, so homes that have been elevated above the previous storm surge are still not high enough. That's partially because the coast has been slowly eaten away by salt water. Randy Verdon is chief of the Bayou Lafourche Band of the Biloxi Chittimacha. He says the problem started in 1927 when the government levied off the Mississippi River, cutting off fresh water from the bayou, and it's been exacerbated by oil companies who took whatever land they wanted and built canals for their pipelines, wreaking havoc on the environment.
You get the salt water coming in through those canals, it starts eating away at the marshland, and basically it just starts falling into the Gulf. There's no vegetation there to hold the land together, so you just start getting this massive land loss. Basically, what used to have a barrier or a buffer zone between us and the storm, we are the buffer zone now. What used to protect us was the land between our homes and the Gulf Coast. So when that water, that surge came, you had land before it actually got to our communities.
Verdon says levees need to be built to protect the community's land from Gulf Coast storms, and unless more fresh water is allowed to come in from the Mississippi River, the tribe's land will simply disappear.
Well, now that land is gone. So when that surge comes, the communities are the first things that it hits. And that's why, for the most part, three out of the four Indian communities here got anywhere between 6 and 8, 10 feet of water, because we were the buffer.
The three Chittimacha tribes and the Pointe aux Chiens are all recognized by the state of Louisiana, but have been trying for over a decade to get federal recognition. Chucky Verdon, chairman of the Pointe aux Chiens tribe, which has had 70 homes damaged by floods and wind, says that lack of recognition means they aren't eligible for programs like scholarships and health care, which could help rebuild the community.
How are they going to fight the big oil companies? So we hope that, you know, get fair recognition that will give us more chance of getting our land back. And a lot of this land where people used to fish, now they can't go there no more. And all people still try going, but they threaten with being arrested or kicked out. You know, you had a lot of fights down here because of land issues.
The tribes are hoping to hear back on their application for recognition by early 2007. In the meantime, the chiefs are meeting regularly for the first time ever to share resources and make joint appeals for help. The 2006 hurricane season starts on June 1st. For FSRN, from Pointe aux Chiens, Louisiana, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
American Indians and non-Indians are protesting the construction of a huge biker bar and concert venue located at the base of Bear Butte, a South Dakota mountain considered sacred to dozens of American Indian tribes. The Bear Butte International Alliance is working to protect the continued encroachment of the sacred site from the expansion of the renewed Sturgis Motorcycle Rally, which takes place every August just a few miles away from Bear Butte and is attended by hundreds of thousands of motorcycle enthusiasts. FSRN's Jim Kent spoke to members of the International Alliance who highlight the importance of preserving the solitude of Bear Butte for those living in western South Dakota and across the country.
Bear Butte is located on an open plain just outside the small town of Sturgis, South Dakota. Its isolation has made it the perfect spot for American Indians to offer prayers for countless generations. The Lakota, the Cheyenne, and the Kiowa are just a few of the dozens of tribes that come to the mountain each year to take part in traditional ceremonies. The first Sturgis Motorcycle Rally was held in 1938. Since then, the growing number of bikers taking part in the rally and the so-called economic development they brought to the area in the form of bars, campgrounds, and vendors has seriously impacted the serenity of Bear Butte. Lakota Jace DeCorey has prayed at the Sacred Mountain for 30 years.
We look upon that as our place where we can continue to receive that spiritual guidance and help so that we can live in this modern day world. It's hard to live in any place nowadays with all the intruding, all the pressures in terms of contemporary society in which money and business and all those things are number one.
As if the situation weren't already serious enough, it was announced last summer that Arizona entrepreneur Jay Allen had purchased 600 acres of land at the base of Bear Butte. The businessman biker did not return calls regarding the project. His website calls the world's largest biker bar that will include 24-hour dining, hot, hot women, and kick-butt music in a 30,000-seat amphitheater. And although Allen has identified himself as being placed in the world by the Creator to preserve the past, Dakota tribal member Jay Redhawk doesn't see hot women and kick-butt music as a means to preserving the traditional spirituality of Bear Butte.
What it boils down to is desecration of a sacred site. It's a national monument. All Americans should be outraged about this because it is on the National Historical Register and it is a state park. The federal government, the state government, and the local governments need to take responsibility along with tribal governments and put a stop to this encroachment once and for all.
The Bear Butte International Alliance was formed 1 month after Allen announced plans for construction of his mega bar complex, which was initially called Sacred Ground. Outcries from the tribal community saw the businessman biker quickly change the name to Sturgis County Line, the only concession Allen has made thus far. At a meeting last Saturday, Alliance spokesperson Nancy Kyle noted that Allen seems unwilling or incapable of appreciating the significance of Bear Butte.
He couldn't understand why we didn't feel like the Native community in this area would be welcoming to his proposal. There's just such a cultural difference in how you respect things.
Yet even the clientele Allen's business is aimed at seems to understand the American Indian standpoint. Biker John Navicus says he enjoys visiting Bear Butte, but recognizes its significance.
My opinion would be
to close it off, let the Native Americans have it as their sacred place. We can view it from the highway. I don't think really we have any business here. This is not our land.
Although construction of Jay Allen's Mega Bar complex has begun, county commissioners have yet to go through the formality of granting him a beer license. A hearing on that issue is scheduled for April 4th. Jay Stacori notes that the Bear Butte International Alliance is inviting all interested parties to protest at the Sturgis Courthouse that day to stop what, for Catholics, would be the equivalent of putting a biker bar at the entrance to Vatican City. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Jim Kent at the base of Bear Butte.
It's been nearly 3 years since Jesus Suarez del Solar, a 20-year-old Marine from San Diego serving in Iraq, stepped on a cluster bomb, which ended his life. To honor the third anniversary of his passing, Jesus's father, Fernando Suarez del Solar, is leading a 241-mile march for peace to make sure that the Latino voice of opposition to the war is heard across the nation. Luis Perez has more from Tijuana.
The march kicked off Sunday morning in Tijuana, the bordering town to San Diego, where Jesus Suarez del Solar was born and educated. About a dozen supporters marched through the streets of Tijuana and crossed the border Sunday afternoon, working their way up to Camp Pendleton, the Marine base where he was trained and deployed to Iraq. According to Fernando Suarez del Solar, this is a very special way of honoring his son's footsteps.
Today I crossed the border legally, the same way my son came into this country, looking to fulfill a dream. Unfortunately, that dream was destroyed by the war. Today I crossed the border to fulfill a dream too, to put an end to the war that destroyed my son's life.
The group marched 21 miles and made their first stop in San Diego's Chicano Park, where they were greeted by a crowd of local supporters. Marching along with Fernando was Pablo Paredes, a Navy war resister who refused to board a ship headed to Iraq on December 6, 2004, and is now an important speaker in the anti-war movement.
By now, any human being should have reached the point where he can no longer sit in his home and wait to have the war end by itself. So as people with hearts who care about the human race, we should find an end to this.
Again, Fernando Suárez del Solar.
3 years ago, you took my son's blood. Now I will give my own blood to save the soldiers who served with my son. How much more blood do you need to put an end to this war?
The marchers will continue holding several anti-war events and demonstrations at stops across California and will culminate in San Francisco on March 27th with a memorial ceremony and a blood donation drive for American troops and Iraqi children. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Luis Perez in Tijuana.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Today's headlines editor is Mitch Jezerich at WBAI, sitting in for Shannon Young. Leon Caldwell is our Washington editor. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Jade Paget-Seekins, Eric Klein, and Antonio Ortiz. For archives of this or any other FSRN newscast or documentary, you can check out our website at www.fsrn.org. www.fsrn.org. You can also email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Thank you.